update session about new developments in the petition committee update. And we start, I think, with Michelle. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is a double act with myself and Patricia. So following on from suggestions that you've previously made, we're going to give an update on both the board's topics and the work that the interpretation we are doing. So, and I think most of you already know Patrina as well. So I take the same approach I've taken in previous meetings, where we'll go through the slides, and then if we have questions or comments, I'll take them as we go through, and then because we've got the people on the video, we'll do a wrap-up at the end as well. So slide three is what we call our 2020 major consultation slide, and I think we presented this slide at the last GPF meeting. So we start with our primary financial statements project, which is now out for comment and we discussed this morning. We've put out our request for information on the second comprehensive review of the IFRS for SME standard. We have a separate consultative group, and so unless you demand, we won't seek your views on that request for information. The goodwill and impairment discussion paper, you've just talked to the team, so I won't go through that. So next up will be some outreach, some structured outreach that we're planning to do on the DRM project. So this is a bit unusual, this approach. What we're going to do is do some outreach with some of the banks on what we've defined as the core model. So we've put together the basis of a future model, and we're going to test the basis of that future model before we get into writing detailed requirements. So a slightly different approach. We're just talking to some of the banks and some of the national standard setters about helping us with that project or that work, and we would see that work beginning in the second quarter of this year. Then probably towards the end of the first half of 2020, we'll put out a request for reviews, well, subject to the board approving at their March board meeting, on the post-implementation reviews of IFRS 10, 11 and 12. So we sought the advice of most of our consultative groups in the last quarter of 2019, including yourselves. I think we got pretty much consistent feedback from GPF members as we got from other groups. Generally, the view is that IFRS 10 and IFRS 12 on the whole work well. There are a few more challenges around IFRS 11. So we will present the findings to the board probably in March, and then seek the board's permission to put out a request for information to understand a bit more around some of the topics that we've heard, and specifically around IFRS 11. And we also discussed at the last meeting the agenda consultation, and the teams are putting together a summary of their findings to discuss with the board at the March meeting. So we'll probably discuss the request for information in the latter part of this year when it's available for comment. So I was just going to pick up two projects that we will be putting out for consultation this year, or we plan at the moment to put out for consultation this year, and just look at those in a bit more detail. The first is the business combinations under common control project, which is on slide. I've put together a slide on slide, which is slide four. So, as you're probably aware, the board took this project on with the aim of improving comparability and the transparency about business combinations under common control. And one of the key questions the board had to address was the measurement approach. So what on this slide you'll see on one side is the current value approach, and on one side is the predecessor approach. So one is a sort of fair value approach, the approach that's used in IFRS 3, and on the other side is using carry forward amounts. And the board's now reached its tentative decisions that we would anticipate being seen in the discussion paper later this year. And what the board has done is has come up with where should it move the line? And that's been quite a difficult question, because we've had a lot of varying feedback on that question, because many jurisdictions already have guidelines, or some of the regulators have rules. So we've had a lot of difficult discussions there. So what the board had started by saying was, does the transaction affect a non-controlling interest? if it doesn't affect a non-controlling interest, then you could carry over the predecessor method. If it does affect a non-controlling interest, is this a public entity? And if it is a public entity, then an approach similar to IFRS 3, a current value approach, would be more appropriate. But if it isn't a public entity, the board said, what about the non-controlling shareholders? So then we asked ourselves the question around IAS 24, and is this a related party? If it is, if all the non-controlling shareholders are related parties, then again you can revert to the or use a predecessor approach. And then if they're not all non-controlling, if all the non-controlling interests are not related parties, but you've chosen to use the predecessor approach and none of them have objected to that, you can still use it. So overall, the board would see a number or the majority of the transactions using a predecessor approach, but just moving the line towards the current value approach and creating more consistency. At the last board meeting, the board discussed the disclosures to support the two proposals. The board decided if you were using a current value approach, you would use the disclosures that are in IFRS 3 combined with the improvements that will be put out in the goodwill paper. And also the board would issue some guidance around IAS 24. And then for the predecessor approach, we would look at the disclosure objectives in IFRS 3 and carry forward some of those disclosure objectives, including details of the transferred entity, the amounts recognised for the major assets, and details of the non-controlling interest. So I think we will see this become a discussion paper probably around the middle of this year. So I don't know if anyone has any questions on that project.
Only a quick one with this. Shareholders been informed and haven't objected.
Yeah.
I wonder whether there should be a kind of a minimum threshold in there. Even a private company can have numerous shareholders, and you always got one who's unhappy with whatever and thinks it's a good idea to create more work for you. So if I think that I have more than 1,000 shareholders and one of them objects, if that's something that should already push me across the line, or do I say I need a minimum number of shareholders or a minimum representation of shareholders that need to need to object?
And we have had that discussion, and that has come up in other consultative groups, and I think it'll be something that we'll have to explore more in the discussion paper. What do you do if one person decides to object to that? Yeah.
Murillo? Murillo,
yes. Yes, thank you. I have a question. The intention regarding not objected to is that the non-controlling shareholder was informed, and perhaps he did not respond to us, and this would be understood as a non-objection, or should we expect him to actually respond to us saying that he does authorize or does not authorize the use of the predecessor approach? But what should I understand as not objecting?
So not objecting means you haven't heard from them, not that you've had an affirmative response. That comment has come up as well. And I think because what we say is, have you informed them and they've not objected? So the emphasis is on the entity informing the non-controlling interest, rather than seeking out a response from every single one.
Sandra?
In the informing of the non-controlling interest, I know in some countries we have non-controlling interest, but over the years you no longer have addresses for them, or, you know, what sort of, is there going to be a threshold required for informing, or... when you have no idea where
I don't know. I can feed it back to the project team about.
Yeah. But we have that. That's not uncommon.
Question is whether something like putting it out on your website, if that enough as an effort to inform, does it need to be they are informed individually?
We'll take it through to. I remember previously writing an accounting standard, actually, and I copied the words out of the of the legal act in the UK. And then I got loads of questions back, and I was like, well, hang on, I just copied this information that's in an act before. So I think it will be a challenge, so we'll feed it back to the team.
Okay.
Yeah, still in this theme, because it's very non-orthodox that, I mean, should we expect some sort of wording saying that, for instance, there should be a certain minimum period that the non-controlling shareholder should have available to respond, or you know, because otherwise the controlling party could simply give one day for the non-controlling shareholder to respond. Maybe that's not feasible. Because that's so different from what I have ever seen in the standards. I'm curious to see how the wording of that requirement will be.
Yeah, it's 10 and a half days, what we decided. No, it's a joke. I think we're working on a discussion paper, and we have not discussed all this detailed stuff. And we first, I think, want to get feedback. Are people happy with the idea? And maybe then in the ED phase, we getting more concrete. What does it mean? How long? What percentage? Is it all or maybe substantially all? Or I don't know. But we have not discussed this detailed question.
But we'll pass them on to the comment team. So the next project I had just highlighted is the management commentary project. And although this project's been on the board's agenda for a while, we really expect to see the board have a number of significant discussions over the next few months. So this month they'll be discussing the objective of the management commentary. So although they had some initial discussions in November 2018, this paper will try and bottom out what the objective is. They'll also look at the disclosure objectives, and we'll be asking our consultative groups about those disclosure objectives. And then there are a number of projects that will come to the board over the next few months before we issue and probably issue a revised exposure draft at the end of the year. But it's a project that we'll probably be discussing later in the year.
It's only that the timing, I think it would be a shame if that had a common period that's pretty much at the same time as people are writing their management reports, because then they may give preference to writing their management reports over commenting on the proposals. Because this is one which you don't only go to the ordinary accounting department to get input. So you need a broader group, and if you come at the time you're pushing them to keep the deadlines for writing their pieces in the management report and say, and could you on top please comment on this proposal, that may not be the best thing you do. So if honestly, if you see that it's getting too close to year end, you may want to revisit the timing.
Okay. And then on slide 7, I've listed the...
On slide 5, I know you're going to discuss risks and opportunities in future board meetings, but just a sensitivity, almost every risk can be rewritten to be an opportunity as well. So be thoughtful about ensuring that risks are properly identified and not just restated to also be an opportunity. I think it's more important that the investors understand the risks of investing in your companies versus what your opportunities are.
I think we've had that discussion here as well about balancing risks and opportunities and how management bias. We've had several discussions in the consultative groups about that. Okay. So, forthcoming amendments. So we have, there's six on this list. PP&E, we have previously discussed, and we would anticipate in March that's one that Petrina looks after, but the effective date for that would be 1 January 2022. With that being for property and plant equipment that's made available after the beginning of the period in which it was presented. Updating the references to the conceptual framework we've discussed previously as well, we would expect that to be published in April, and again, that would be effective from 1 January 2022. Katrina will be issuing her annual improvements, which are all 1 January 2022, so there's three annual improvements to be released this year. And then later in the year, the board has now concluded its deliberations on onerous contracts, which is an amendment to IS 37, and that will be effective from 1/22. And then accounting policies and accounting estimates will be a bit later in the year as well. I think we've spent some time in the past discussing that. We would see the IFRS 17 amendment still being issued mid-year, and the board are, I think, aiming to conclude deliberations of the topics this month. In terms of things that are currently out for comment or the board is considering feedback on, primary financial statements and the RFI for the IFRS for SMEs are the two major projects that are out for comment. The board is going to consider the feedback on the deferred tax, and at last month's meeting it discussed but didn't make any decisions on the feedback that it had on the disclosure initiative, the accounting policy disclosures, which I know we discussed in the last meeting here. And then in terms of other technical projects, we've added two new projects to our, or the board's added two new projects to its agenda since we met last time. I'll just run through those, and then Martin will give you an overview of where the board are in its deliberations of the exposure draft. So for the subsidiaries that are SMEs, this is a project where the board have agreed to look at drafting a new IFRS, and the IFRS will allow subsidiaries that are SMEs, which for this purpose is subsidiaries that do not have public accountability, and will use the definition of public accountability from our IFRS for SME standard. So the new standard will be a reduced disclosure standard, and it will tell entities that opt to apply the standard what disclosures they need to give and what IFRS disclosures they won't be giving or they don't need to give. So we see it as being voluntary for those entities that it's eligible, so voluntary for entities that aren't. So the benefits are hopefully to preparers in that it should be less costly to prepare the financial statements of those subsidiaries, and for users of those subsidiaries, they should have more relevant information. We probably see an exposure draft in the early part of next year, because there's quite a lot of analysis for us to do to go through the disclosures that are in IFRS standards and compare them to the IFRS for SME standard disclosures, which is our starting point. And then the other project the board...
Maybe briefly on that one. How would that be codified?
What do you mean?
So we got the SME standard, which is a different set of rules. We got the big book. Yeah? And where would I put that? Would that be a third regime? Or
no,
would these companies deem to be IFRS compliant?
So what we envisage at the moment is that this would be an IFRS standard that you would, if you are a subsidiary and you meet and you don't have public accountability, you would be eligible to apply this standard. And this standard would say, don't apply these disclosure requirements, and it would list out the IFRS disclosure requirements you don't apply, but you apply these disclosure requirements. So all the IFRS for SMEs is doing is giving us the starting point for the disclosures. There'll be no cross-reference.
Okay, but that means a company that would do that would express full IFRS compliance.
Well, we think we'd have to do an amendment to IFRS 1, although we haven't taken this to the board. This is just the staff, where we would probably say people would have to express that they've opted to apply this standard, but it's not something we've discussed with the board.
No, I'm rather coming from the perspective whether legislators need to do anything other than endorsing that standard.
I think the purpose was that people should, because they have the requirement on local regulatory to make IFRS accounts, full IFRS accounts, and we want to ease that, so it should be full IFRS.
Okay. No, I'm fully
because it was a purpose. It was a purpose of doing
so. So I've had some initial discussions with some jurisdictions, including the EU, and we see this as being an IFRS standard that would just be endorsed by the normal processes.
Very good.
And then the board has decided to add a project to its agenda on provisions, although we probably won't start work on this project straight away. So this is, I think we've come and talked to you about the research that we have done on IS 37 and the provision standard. What we've heard is the standard generally works well, but there's some areas that we could look to improve. And so on in the slides, I've set out the three areas where the board would be looking to improve it. One is the feedback we've heard around IFRIC 21, and so sort of aligning the standard with the conceptual framework. We would look at the feedback that we've had around onerous contracts and how to measure those onerous contracts, what costs should be included in the measurement of an onerous contract. And then we would look at providing some guidance and some requirements on which discount rate to use. And then the other project, Martin was just going to run through the IBOR slide.
Yeah. Slide 9, IBOR. When you know that we had done the phase 1 of the IBOR reform, which dealt with more or less the uncertainty before contracts really changed to new reference rate. And phase 2 is now really in this phase where companies, entities change their contracts to reflect a new reference rate coming back from IBOR to these new rates. And on slide 9, we say, okay, timing is essential because many companies already doing that in 2020. And therefore, I think we are keen that we get this as soon as possibly done. And the timeline is that the board has already finalized the deliberation and staff is now in the process of drafting that. And expect the publication is then in quarter 2 this year. And we finally plan that its effective date is then 1st Jan 2021, but people can earlier apply the standard so that they already for the financial year 2020 can then use it. What is phase two about? As I said, it is more or less when companies then modifying contracts, which they have reference to a variable rate, which is LIBOR, then to the new rate. And the question is, what does it mean? Because when IFRS 9 then, usually, if you do modification, you have consequences that you have to adjust effective interest rate and then book a modification gain or loss, or you have to de-recognize if it is a big modification, and then you have to then recognize a new kind of financial instrument, which is then very difficult. You have also consequences in hedge accounting, and the board tried to address this kind of issues to make it easier for modifications which are modifications only dealing with this kind of changing the reference rate. There are other modifications, for example, if you also change interest rate because credit ratings is different, then I think this simplification and this would not apply because then the usual IFRS modifications you have to do, so it's only limited to this kind of simple modification for the purpose of reflecting the new reference rates. What are the modifications? As I said, I cannot go into the details, but it's more or less that if you're doing it for a variable interest rate and just replacing, for example, LIBOR to then the new rate with a kind of a spread, then you don't have to apply the modification. You can use it like you have adjusted a new variable interest rate currently in IFRS 9. So you continue, calculate a new effective interest rate, calculate new cash flows, but you don't have to book a modification gain or loss. So continue as if you currently have updated your variable interest rate. So quite easy and don't have to do all this modification stuff. And you have some easing of hedge accounting because when you, for example, then adjust your underlying item or your hedged instrument by then using a reference rate, then you have to change documentation because LIBOR is not maybe any longer your hedged risk. It is a kind of different risk. And usually if you change hedge documentation, you have to also distinguish the hedge accounting and start a new stuff. And with this kind of easing, this kind of requirements, you can adjust hedge documentation without then closing the hedge, and you can continue to do hedge accounting, and don't you have to all this kind of negative impact. So it is really to don't have a kind of one hand side to help prepare us. We're doing the IBOR reform, but also for the users, I think it would not make a lot of sense if you then all these hedge accounting requirements, you close, book a gain and loss, and then starting a kind of new hedge accounting. In addition, okay, that is a kind of new disclosure requirement that is more or less about what are the main risks about the IBOR reform and how the entities have dealt with this kind of risk. You should not think, okay, that is only for banks. It is also kind of, if we have looked at other standards, IFRS 17, lease, I think we have also an issue where you have maybe variable interest rates, and if you update that, what could happen then in lease accounting. It is also dealt in this kind of amendments with, and so be careful not if you think that you are not a bank, you don't have to deal with IBOR reform. Any questions to that? Yes, we have one.
Sunat?
I would like you to refer to slide number 8, the last item, financial instruments with characteristics of equity. I would like to know the project status. Last year when we discussed, I thought you will be issuing some sort of exposure draft in June 2020 or so. What has changed in terms of the timeline? I would like to hear a bit more on that project status of this.
I don't have the exact timeline with me, but...
So I don't think we have a timeline on the work plan for that project at the moment. I think the board on our work plan, it says the board is still looking at the project direction. So my understanding is that the board have asked the project team to do some follow-up research on some of the disclosures that we had that were in the discussion paper. So...
And the overall status is a little bit that we, you know, that the feedback for what we have proposed was not so positive. People had concerns, but people also liked or have acknowledged that we have issues in IAS 32. And what the board has decided now to address certain of the most relevant issues and try to find a solution for these most relevant issues and improve disclosure. We had start first deliberation on the first issue, and we will continue doing it step by step by step, and then try to think, okay, if that overall solves the IAS 32 problems which we have. But we don't following this kind of general approach to think, okay, distinction what is liability and equity. We want to find solutions for individual problems and then take it from there. Was that right, Anne?
Yes, it's about the board agreed for the staff to look at using information that was collected in the process of the consultation, but really focusing on IAS 32 as it is now, and as Martin said, addressing problems. It's the decision of the board was not to take a view of continuing with what was proposed in the discussion paper, so the new principles and concepts. The board won't be working on that. At the other end would be a disclosure-only solution, and the board didn't go there either, though there will be some work around to what extent could disclosures address these specific problems that have been identified.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Ian?
Just a quick one, and I'm rather fishing here, but on primary financials, obviously it's out for comment until 30 June, and I can imagine you're going to get quite a lot of varied comments back. Do you have an approximate sort of feeling or timeline of when the final standard might come? I mean, I won't hold you to it, but I could guess it won't come that quickly.
I think it's difficult really to say. It would be guessing. And usually what would it take? We take maybe half a year of lead deliberation. We then, if that works well, we need another half of then drafting the final standard. I don't know. But it depends on the feedback, as always.
revenue took 10
yeah,
years.
If you guys are all happy with what we have proposed, it is very fast. If not, it takes longer. That's how it is.
You see, it will take longer.
Yeah, I'd expect it sort of mid-2021 earlier, was my guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Minimum, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and then...
Murillo has another question, sorry.
Just a quick one. Are there any news regarding the research on extractive activities?
Anne can take it, it's probably best.
So we haven't done anything new on the extractive activities project because the team, some of the key team people have been on the Goodwill project. But once the DP for Goodwill goes out very, very soon, we'll go back to extractive activities. So it, yes, it's right that the staff did have some more research they wanted to do. The focus was really picking up research from countries that are now part of IFRS standards but didn't really comment when we had the previous discussion paper. So that's, I'd say that's still in progress. I haven't got anything really to report on progress because there has been a bit of delay.
Thank you.
I would just recommend we've got an IFRS oil and gas committee that meets. We would always welcome any comments or requests for information within that committee.
Yeah, great.
Good.
Okay, so I have listed the requirements that come into effect just so that everyone's aware of them. But if there are no further comments, I'm going to hand over to Petrina.
Okay. Great, thank you. Thank you, Michelle. So starting on sort of slide 17, we've just put a few slides together around the work of the committee. And so starting in slide 17, of course, it just gives you the high-level overview, really, of the sort of amount of activity that's been going on at the committee in 2019. And actually, before going into some of the detail of the questions, one of the questions when I talk about the committee's work, by the way, I think almost because of both the varying nature and maybe what looks like the sometimes unusual nature of the particular topics we talk about, I'll often get asked almost why. Well, why is the Interpretations Committee talking about football player transfer fees or airline compensation payments or stock exchange listing fees? That looks, you know, incredibly specific. So first of all, I thought it might be helpful just as a reminder, of course, to say that neither the committee nor, by the way, to my dismay sometimes, do we have sort of any control over either the timing of the questions that we get nor the nature of the questions that we get, because the process is, of course, very much designed to be available to stakeholders where those stakeholders have questions about how to apply the standards when there is perhaps some doubt about exactly how to read the requirements. So, by the way, what that has meant is actually in 2019, the committee was particularly busy. So those 33 topics, you see that was a particularly busy year for the committee. The first part of 2020 has been less busy. And I think that also just reflects, if you look at slide 18, the fact that during 2019, there were still quite a lot of questions coming into the committee around what we called the bigger, newer standards. So a lot of the questions were focused around 9, 15 and 16. And of course, the other things you see in that slide is often the committee will get questions where there either are newish types of transactions. So some cloud computing stuff, cryptocurrencies came through. The committee also gets questions when there's sort of maybe a new situation comes along. So, for example, there were three questions that more recently came into the committee on hyperinflationary accounting and how does the applying IAS 29 and IAS 21 interact? And those questions very much came in the context of Argentina becoming a hyperinflationary economy in 2018. So maybe what I was going to do, just in looking in slide 18, by the way, all these topics are listed here because I'm very open to if anybody has any questions on any of these or on what you see on slide 19, please ask. But maybe what I was going to do was just highlight one or two, even if just to give you a flavour of some of the types of things that the committee has discussed. And I think what comes across often, as I say, is that the committee will get a particular question coming from a particular industry sector or on a very particular thing, transaction or fact pattern. But often what that highlights is that it relates to a particular broader aspect of how our requirements work. So maybe if I look at IFRS 15 and both the question we got on promised goods or services and also on airline compensation payments. So both of those, first of all, the one on promised goods or services came in and it was very specifically about how a stock exchange recognises revenue and whether a stock exchange could recognise what is an upfront non-refundable payment that it gets when companies list with it, whether it could recognise that as revenue at the start of the contract. So the question, therefore, in IFRS 15 words was really, is there a separate performance obligation, in a sense, where a service is transferred to the customer on day one and then sort of a separate ongoing service? And so with that question, by the way, the conclusion the committee reached now is there is just one service here. The revenue gets recognised over the period of the contract. And what that question sort of really drew out was the fact that IFRS 15 is very much saying that you recognise revenue to reflect the transfer of goods or services to the customer. You don't recognise revenue necessarily just when you as an entity are doing quite a lot of activity in the context of a contract. So it's all about when does a good or service transfer to a customer. On airline compensation payments, by the way, it's something we'll all be aware of when we fly on airplanes, but of course there is this question come in the context of legislation that requires airlines to compensate customers if there are delayed or cancelled flights. Again, a specific question, and the question here was again about revenue. What hits the revenue line? In this case, what hits the revenue line versus expenses? So if an airline has this obligation to make compensation payments to customers, does that get reflected in the revenue they're recognised? Is it an embedded part of the consideration that's sort of paid to the airline to transport customers on their planes? Or instead, is it more compensation that's paid for harm or damage that might get recognised as an expense? And so in this case, by the way, the committee concluded based on IFRS 15 that this was variable consideration. It was very much an embedded part of the consideration that the airline can expect to deliver its promise in this contract, which is to transfer the customer to a particular destination within a specified time frame. So these were just a couple I was going to highlight in IFRS 15.
Just on that one, mm-hmm. So you have a sale of a ticket and the flight is cancelled and there's a incremental penalty. Mm-hmm. So you would say reduce your revenue by more than your original revenue? Or is the penalty really a separate cost?
So what we'd say, so you've asked a very good question, Sandra. No, and the reason, by the way, it's a good question is you've hit on, and I can now clarify, sort of what the committee addressed in its response and what it didn't address, which is quite important, by the way. So there could be a difference, by the way. The compensation often comes up either for delayed flights or it can come up for cancelled flights. And I think there can be a slight difference because, of course, if a flight ends up being cancelled, then potentially there's nothing is going into the revenue line because the service just hasn't happened. On a delayed flight, there can still be amounts going into the revenue line because, of course, you still have performed. You've still ultimately, transported this customer to the destination. It's just not within time. And in that case, that's where it might more affect the revenue. Now, one part of the question that came in is what you hit on, is that sometimes because this compensation is driven by legislation, And it's often sort of blanket amounts, I might say, depending on particular lengths of flights. So the amount of the compensation is not necessarily any way linked to the ticket price, and even can result for some low-cost tickets in saying that the compensation would end up being more than the ticket price. All that the committee concluded in this context, by the way, is that you don't automatically consider anything you pay as compensation just to be more an expense that doesn't affect your revenue. It says this is an embedded part of the consideration. So when you look at IFRS 15, you consider it to be like penalties in construction contracts as part of variable consideration. What the committee didn't address was whether if you're in the situation that the compensation would take you to a kind of negative amount for that ticket. Do you only take your revenue down to zero in that case, or potentially could you have negative revenue? So that was left open. The reason it was left open was, first of all, it wasn't directly the question asked, but we felt there wasn't anything helpful, let's say, the committee to do in the context of what IFRS 15 says. It's more that because IFRS 15 itself doesn't sort of directly talk about negative revenue situations, we stopped at and sort of didn't go on to talk about that.
Okay. Although it is a heavily debated topic, can there be negative revenue under IFRS 15?
Yeah.
So I guess that will come back to the committee at some point.
It could
not,
do.
Not for the for this specific case.
Yeah.
But in a different context, I could imagine that this would come back to me.
It could do, or it could even be something, for example, that people might say, you know, you didn't pick up when you initially did IFRS 15. Is it for the PIR of IFRS 15?
Because the outcome of the TRG discussion was more than blurry in that respect.
Yeah. If I maybe move on to just, I'll just mention a couple around IFRS 16 as well. The first one is, of course, on lease term. Now, the question the committee got in on lease term was sort of very specifically to lease contracts that continue to run until either party terminates. So it's not contracts that have a very fixed end date, it's contracts that maybe have an initial period, but then just continue to stay in place and run until either party terminates the contract. And so the question that the committee got was to ask whether, look, do I view such a contract in that case as saying the contract just ends when either party can terminate, or do I, when I'm thinking about lease term, do I need to assess, actually do an assessment of whether the lessee is reasonably certain to extend beyond that date? So just do I automatic stops with no assessment, or do I actually need to consider whether the lessee is reasonably certain to extend in those situations? And so what the committee concluded was, based on the requirements in IFRS 16 at the minute, that to the extent and for one of those contracts that the lessee is economically incentivised to continue to continue to lease this asset, then it should actually assess whether it's reasonably certain to extend beyond that initial date when it could be terminated. So it basically said economics matter. And if the lessee would be economically incentivised to continue, then you should look at whether the lessee is reasonably certain to extend. The other questions I was just going to highlight on leases were a couple on the definition of a lease. I suppose, again, by the way, following the theme, quite specific questions, but I think drew out just slightly broader points. So the two questions we had, one was for a particular shipping contract. The other was for a contract for subsurface rights, rights to put pipes or wires underground. And both of them, of course, the question was, does the contract contain a lease? In both cases, the committee's response was it did contain a lease, but what both questions drew out were sort of different things. First of all, the question that came in on the sort of subsurface rights really helped draw out what does IFRS 16 mean when it talks about an identified asset and talks about there can be an identified asset when there's a physically distinct portion of a larger asset. So it really helped understand what is meant by physically distinct portion. And the question on the shipping contract was one actually that drew out sort of how do you assess decision-making rights when potentially quite a few, many, most of the decision-making rights are predetermined in the contract, and then there's just some decision-making that happens sort of during the contract. So again, those are kind of specific questions, but I think they're quite helpful in drawing out how to apply IFRS 16 in some of those situations. The other topic, take questions at any point, that I was going to mention was one that Christoph mentioned to me yesterday, and aren't actually in the slides, so I think it's worth mentioning. It's one, by the way, that when we got this question, I tried to use to convince my son that my job was less boring than he might think it is, which is that we got a question directly from a football club about how they account for transfer fees that they receive when they sell players, in a sense, or will they transfer players to another club. And by the way, my son is absolutely fanatical about football, so that was my hope on this. And so anyway, what the question really touched on, and again, by the way, it was a question about revenue, this case revenue versus net gain or loss. So the question was that this club was saying, look, an embedded part, we are a club whose business model, an embedded part of my business model is not only to have the football club play and generate quite a lot of advertising income, commercial income, tickets, fields, an embedded part of our business model is that we also generate quite a lot of income from bringing in young players, developing them and transferring them onto other clubs. And so the question really was saying that those fees that I get paid when I transfer those players on, can I recognise that as revenue because I view it to be part of my ordinary activities, or instead do I need to just recognise a net gain or loss in my income statement, on the basis, by the way, that any cost incurred when that player was brought to the club and was registered and was recognised as an intangible asset applying IAS 38. And so the kind of wider question underlying this was, if I have an asset that I've used in my business, but then I turn around at some point and sell it, when I sell that asset that I've previously used in my business, can I recognise revenue from that, or is it just net gain or loss? At the moment, by the way, that one is still not being finalised by the committee. It's at a tentative stage. Tentatively, the committee, in an agenda decision, spelled out its conclusion based on what IAS 38 says, which is that in its view in that case, IAS 38 says when you dispose of an intangible you've used, you just recognise a net gain or loss. You're not recognising revenue. As I say, that one has been out for comment. The comment period closed in the middle of February, so it's yet to come back to the committee for them to consider comment letters.
Maybe, if I may, a few comments on it. Why did I raise this? Number one, it's a concern, because I think the question that is dealt with is a very generic one. What if I use something one way and then sell it to my customers? Does that create revenue or not? You would assume it's a revenue because revenue is income from ordinary activities. So if in the case with that club, it's an ordinary activity to sell these players and make a part of your money through selling them, not only through have them play for you, I think it's ordinary activity. But it's a very generic question, and it happens in a lot of industries. My concern is now, because this is such a narrow fact pattern, that anyone, if not for the passion for football, would not look into this, because you look at the title and you would say, no, I don't have players, I have nothing like that. But you don't see that underlying you may have a big issue with that. And we saw it yesterday, one or two of the colleagues who didn't pay attention to that before suddenly said, oh gosh, I think I'm having this. So that is number one. Number two, while I fully understand where the committee is coming from based on current IFRS, I think we're moving into something that is very odd to me, because the question of whether I generate revenue from something that I used before depends on what was the use before. There is explicit guidance that if I lease an asset out and then later sell it, that before selling it, I reclassify to inventory, sell it, and it generates revenue and operating cash inflow. It's the same thing if something is initially used as an investment asset under IAS 40 and then sold, again, the standard tells you, reclassify to inventory, sell and generate revenue. Now, I struggle to see a principle that tells me, well, if it was leasing or investment, you generate revenue, while if your use of the maybe identical asset was something other than lease and investment, then the ultimate sale will have a very different impact on your financials. Difficult to understand what is the underlying principle, though it sounds very much a rule-based thing. And I mean, you mentioned yesterday that this IS-16 thing was put in there at some point without a lot of debate on principles. Mm-hmm. So this together is something that I fully understand where the committee is coming from, but I would love the committee to raise this topic to the board in a way of, listen, this is the outcome we have at the moment, but number one, we think it's a much broader topic than only football players. Mm-hmm. And number two, we think we've got a weakness here in IFRS that needs to be addressed by generically addressing the topic, internal use with subsequent sale to a customer, what is the right accounting for it?
Just to let you know, Christoph, because I'm glad you mentioned it to me yesterday, because I can update you to let you know that, as I say, the comment period on this ended in the middle of February. So we have, I think there are 18 comment letters received on our website on it, and I know from the team that it is.
But not from Manchester and Liverpool and Bayern Munich. You easily have 18 football clubs responding.
I haven't actually looked at the names to see if we've got any glamorous titles, but I saw 18.
You may ask your son, who may immediately identify the logos on them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He can tell me them all. What I was going to say was I am aware from the team that at least some of those comment letters have mentioned this wider thing to say, you know, maybe that's worth looking at. So maybe just on slide 19, I wasn't necessarily going to spend more time. On slide 19, by the way, we had our March Interpretations Committee meeting just 2 days ago. So both sale and lease back that you see in slide 19 and IS-12 there, actually, and the hyperinflationary accounting are all just fresh off the out of the meeting, in a sense, in terms of decisions made. I'm happy to talk about any of that if anybody wants to know. But maybe I'll just pause now and see if anybody has particular questions or if there's...
You're about IS-12.
Anything else? Oh, the question on IS-12, yeah. Yeah, so this was a question that came in, and actually I'm not giving anything away to say the submission came in very much in relation to how tax works in some Eastern European countries. So the submission itself identified Estonia and Latvia and North Macedonia. It relates to, as I say, how the tax regime works there. And the question was whether about in consolidated financial statements, did the group, in a sense, have to recognise deferred tax for any temporary difference that might arise from undistributed profits in the subsidiary. And the particular fact pattern, whether you have to recognise it, was because the undistributed rate in these jurisdictions is zero, and the distributed rate is 20%. So in a sense, sort of the question was, is that potentially if you were either looking at using the undistributed rate, you potentially wouldn't recognise any deferred tax. But if there was a temporary difference and they had to recognise deferred tax, if they had to use the distributed rate, then it's a 20% rate and would need to recognise it. Now, this very much... often when this question arises, part of the assumptions and the fact pattern, and the reason there was the question here was there is actually, it was assumed in the fact pattern that a recognition exemption that fits in IS-12 was not met. Because I think you probably know it's paragraph 39 of IS-12, and we understand that very often in practice people end up not recognising deferred tax in this situation, but because they meet the recognition exemption conditions that sit in paragraph 39 of IS-12. This fact pattern that we were told, already assume that the entity itself has decided it does not meet those conditions because it expects the distribution to actually be made in the foreseeable future. So in that respect, then what the committee has tentatively concluded is that in that fact pattern, you would in the consolidated accounts, you would recognise deferred tax at the distributed rate in this case. Because the recognition exception does not apply and there is a temporary difference that arises from the undistributed profits. So that one will go out for comment probably next week and then be open for comment for 60 days.
Okay, thanks, Petrina. Any further questions, comments? Ian?
Sorry, I didn't read it, but could you maybe just say a couple of words about hyperinflation?
Sure.
Just a couple of words.
It's hard. I'm sorry. You see, if you ask me a question, I'll just get going. I'm sure, Ian, because you've experienced it, you'll know what's hard to talk about in hyperinflation is just narrowing it down. One of the maybe the important things to probably highlight is I know that those of you that have to apply hyperinflationary accounting, I think there are potentially quite a few questions arise, but at least I'll tell you the questions that the committee were asked and therefore have responded to. So the specific question asked is a situation where, you know, you potentially, you're again a group preparing consolidated financial statements. You're potentially sitting in Switzerland with, of course, a non-hyperinflationary group presentation currency, and you have to translate your Argentinian foreign operation results and financial position to include in your consolidated financial statements. And Argentina is now, of course, the functional currency of your Argentinian foreign operation is now hyperinflationary. That, of course, means you need to restate, first of all, the Argentinian results and financial position according to IAS 29 to take account of inflation, and then you come along and apply IAS 21 in embedding that foreign operation in your consolidated accounts. And what the question that came to the committee was twofold on the same thing. One was about where do you recognise any sort of difference. We called it consolidation difference, but both the difference that arises from restating the Argentinian foreign operation and that arises from translating that into your accounts, where do you present those restatement and translation effects? Can they get recognised directly in equity, or are they recognised in that separate component of OCI that would subsequently get recognised in P&L when you dispose of the foreign operation? So that was first of all the question: on an ongoing basis, does that get recognised directly in equity and sort of never recycled, I might say, or is it recognised as an exchange difference in sort of accumulated currency translation reserve? And then sort of a similar question, but that comes up just on first-time application, which is the question was, when I first apply hyperinflationary accounting, so when my foreign operation first becomes hyperinflationary, of course, in the consolidated financial statements, there would have been an accumulated currency translation reserve sitting in OCI in relation to that foreign operation, but before it became hyperinflationary. Can I do a reclassification there and put that into a component of equity that wouldn't get recycled, or does it kind of need to stay in currency translation reserve? So very particular questions about what sort of gets booked or stays in your currency translation reserve versus what do I book directly in equity. The committee just this week decided to finalise its tentative decisions, and it concluded that any exchange differences do need to be recognised as in OCI, in a sense, and in that currency translation reserve. That would then subsequently be reclassified to P&L when you dispose of your subsidiary. And that means when you first apply hyperinflationary accounting, you can't just do a reclassification of everything that was sitting in your currency translation reserve. You may remeasure that amount on first applying your IAS 29 accounting, but you don't just do a kind of blanket reclassification of everything that was there.
But it would be reclassified upon disposal of the hyperinflationary entity, not upon discontinuing hyperinflation accounting. So if that subsidiary, let's assume Argentina starts to do better and the subsidiary is no longer hyperinflationary, I would still leave it in there. Like all the other currency stuff, and it would only recycle upon a future disposal of the entity.
Yeah. On that, on that sort of theme, in a sense, not the same topic, I did have a slide on the lack of exchangeability project on slide 20. Does anybody want a quick update on that, or have you had enough of exchange differences?
Nobody is raising immediate hands. So.
I could have gone into excruciating detail on this.
No, I think people looking forward for the disclosure initiative. But thank you very much to Michelle and Petrina for this update.
Thanks a lot, and that was the first time we've done that, including the IFRIC stuff, and what we got to collect feedback from the group. My initial reaction is it is helpful to do that, and I think the discussions around the topics have shown that. So, but we will collect feedback on that.
Yeah, we used to do it a number of years ago, maybe before you were involved, right. And then it stopped, but I think that's very helpful as well.
Well, great. We're certainly very happy to come along. So.
Thanks again.